Welcome to the Hoban Minute, a podcast that will shift your perspective on the business, politics, and culture of the hemp and marijuana industries. I'm your host, Xavier Jaye. It's 420 somewhere, so let's dive in.
What's going on, cannabis industry? This is Xavier, your host for the Hoban Minute, and I'm joined today by Bob Hoban. How are you, Bob?
I'm doing great today. You know, it's the holiday season. It's coming up on the end of the year, and, there's a lot of things going on, but it's always good to sit down and recap the year in cannabis.
Yes, it's been a little bit since we had a chance to record an episode, so I'm looking forward to getting a sense of, you know, what you've been up to this year, what the industry has been up to this year, and maybe a little bit of you know, what you expect from the industry in 2024. Just to kind of lay out, I guess, the structure of today, really just want to focus on kind of the major news stories in the cannabis industry in 2023, recap some of those, you know, provide our thoughts and analysis, and then again, maybe a little bit of a forward-looking discussion for what's to come. Starting with, I think, probably the biggest news story from this year, and that was the Biden administration, the White House, directing HHS to perform study. Well, This directive was at the end of last year, right? And so directing HHS to perform studies and research and collect data on potentially rescheduling cannabis. And then in this year, in August, I want to say, HHS finalized their study, issued a report, and sent a recommendation to the DEA that marijuana should be rescheduled to Schedule 3. Now, this has been, you know, a news topic that has been controversial, to say the least. There's contingents of the cannabis industry that are, I'd say, incrementalists. You know, they look at any change
as schedule or bust.
Well, that's the thing, right? There's the incrementalists that say, okay, any change is positive. We'll take what we can get. And then, as you just said, there's the deschedulers or busts. The guys that are like, oh, I've been saying I got to deschedule since 1988. And if we don't deschedule, the industry is dead. I'm not so sure I agree. I do think that descheduling would be fantastic. That should be the end goal, no doubt, or legalization. Why stop at descheduling, right? But the process to get there doesn't happen, you know, with a snap of finger. It's complicated.
No, so when you want to reschedule, reclassify a controlled substance, if you do this through the executive branch, you do what the president has done. He, as you point out, you ask Health and Human Services to examine the science behind the compound and to make a recommendation accordingly to none other than the DEA. And then the DEA, who has yet to take a stand on this recommendation, as I understand it, would effectively be bound by those scientific findings. And they have to. And here, HHS recommended, as you point out, in 2023, that cannabis should be rescheduled from Schedule 1, the most restrictive category, high potential for abuse, no recognized medical benefit, pretty significant, to Schedule 3, which includes things such as Tylenol with codeine. All right? And that's an important thing. Bookmark that thought for a moment. The other way to reclassify a controlled substance, whether that's to decontrol, deschedule it, or reschedule it, would be through an act of Congress. Congress can do that. To move from Schedule 1 to descheduling, politically speaking and practically speaking, would require an act of Congress. There would have to be political will to take something from that high potential for abuse, no recognized medical benefit, to we're not going to control it at all. Well, but it would require political will. If you're asking an agency and their scientist to evaluate where cannabis, marijuana should be scheduled, it's going to be based on science, not based on political will. And science says that cannabis does have a medical benefit, and that cannabis does have a low or lower potential for abuse versus what has historically been known. So if science dictates that, science is going to say move it from Schedule 1 to another schedule. Science is not going to say deschedule it. That has to be a political maneuver. So that's why we are where we are. Now, the upshot of that rescheduling would be alleviating the pressure of 280E, the tax impact, which I think most of us understand now is a stranglehold on the industry, strangles the industry, suffocates the industry. But then furthermore, if you think about the other implication of Schedule 3, it means that these companies in the marijuana space still would not necessarily comply with FDA standards and guidelines that would be required to truly comply with what a Schedule 3 product producer would do. Like, take, for example,
serious facilities.
Tylenol with codeine. Tylenol is a company that has scientists, that has research facilities, that has production and manufacturing facilities all around the United States and likely around the world. I don't know that. That's not my world, but I imagine outside of the United States as well.
Well, if some of the haters have their way, then it might become your world, because cannabis might just become a big pharma play.
Obviously, that's my favorite one. The pharmaceutical execs, the tobacco execs, and the alcohol execs are all
waiting for this,
canoodling to take it all over. Yeah, because they want to own the functional equivalent of liquor stores. That was sarcasm as well. But so let's look at that though. If you're Tylenol, you have to create products by a very high standard across the board, your entire supply chain.
And consistency.
Consistency.
That's a big thing. Every Tylenol pill has to be exactly the same as every other Tylenol pill.
Exactly. And it has to have gone through studies to prove its efficacy, that it works, that it does what it says it does, so that you can represent that on your packaging. Tell me a cannabis company in the world that presently can meet those standards. There might be some out there. There's a bunch of ones that we obviously don't know about. We don't pretend to know everybody. But that's a really high standard. So you're still, even with Schedule 3, you might have 280E eliminated in terms of that impact, but you still are not complying with federal law. So you still do require some sort of carve-out or exception, like the federal spending prohibition that has prevented the Department of Justice going after state medical-approved marijuana facilities, originally known as Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment, and sort of has been called other things since that time. So my point is, Schedule 3 will likely occur, and I do believe it will occur before Election Day in 2024. I think the president needs all the help he can get. And that's not a political statement. I just think it's going to be a dogfight in this upcoming election, and every vote counts. And if you want the cannabis industry on your side, then you're going to have to make sure that this takes place to get and secure those votes for Election Day. The other upshot of all of this would be that banks and mainstream entities that would not touch a Schedule 1 substance, because a Schedule 1 substance truly has no value in the world. It's just prohibited based on that standard.
Marijuana being one of them, no.
Yeah. But then all of a sudden, it's a Schedule 3. So a bank might not want to deal with someone who sells the functional equivalent of a Schedule 1 substance, but they're going to bank a company that sells Tylenol with codeine all day long. They're going to loan to a company that sells Tylenol with codeine all day long. So that's the upshot. And that's a
massive,
pretty significant upshot.
No, it's been one that the industry's been begging for years now, with the STATES Act and the Safe Banking Act, actually, was the first iteration. And I think it really, as we continue to see with kind of the political climate and Supreme Court rulings recently, it's states and political questions like this are going to be more and more a states' rights issue. We're going to see, state voters have the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to have, I don't know, legal cannabis within their borders, whether or not they want to give access to abortion to their citizens, right? As we continue to see kind of these controversial topics, And it will be, you know, state voters that define what that state does and how it approaches cannabis and what sort of model the state adopts, whether or not it's a red state model that's only, you know, hemp-derived products, whether or not it's a medical marijuana system that really truly is seeking to give, you know, medicine to terminally ill patients, whether or not it's a quasi-medical system with a chronic pain catch-all that's really just a recreational market, or if it is just a full recreational market. So I think we continue to see...
And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. That's built into the American system. States' rights, state by state by state, get to elect what they would like to do based on their citizens' preferences. That's okay. It's normal. It's American.
Yep. So I think that's what we continue to see, just with less burden and oversight from the federal government with regards to certain things like taxation. So I think all in all, a very positive move and a very positive signal for the cannabis industry moving forward, regardless of what, you know, the naysayers will say. And so speaking of states' rights, I think that's a good kind of transition into another major topic of this year. And that's really kind of the continued, you know, rollout of marijuana markets in the United States. We had a number of states, you know, potentially swing states, battleground states, red states, right? These states that, you know, five years ago, people wouldn't have thought would allow for, you know, adult use legislation. I think Ohio is a great example. But we're continuing to see that rollout. And I think now we've got, I mean, I don't know if it's over 25 states that have some form of a medical or a marijuana market. And that's not including the red states with the red state weed. And so, that's really been another big topic this year, kind of that rollout. But then also, speaking of red state weed, looking at how states are approaching regulating what we call IHDs, you know, intoxicating hemp derivatives. And in particular, of course, the products that those derivatives end up in. But we have seen many states, in the absence of some federal regulation, the absence of some federal, you know, structure or framework for these operators, the states are taking it upon themselves to do so. We had, you know, on one hand, our home state of Colorado swung pretty hard in one direction as far as trying to prohibit or at least contain these products within the existing marijuana system. And then we had other states, you know, I think Florida maybe is a good example, that said, well, you know, these products are being used by our citizens. Let's just make sure that no one under the age of 21 is gaining access to these products. They're not really being sold in a way that appeals to children. And then, you know, adults, consenting adults, can do whatever they want to do. They can purchase cannabis, whether or not it's derived from, you know, marijuana or hemp. So I don't know. Love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the states early in the legislative season, which, you know, starts usually after the new year, the end of January, roughly. In most states, they thought about banning IHDs because it wasn't really understood. And then they realized very quickly that if you ban something, it doesn't make it go away. It just means that there's products that are being produced, sold, and used by consumers that are not meeting any sort of prescribed safety standard.
I don't know if I'm crazy, but it's like deja vu from alcohol prohibition. The 18th Amendment was passed. Alcohol became illegal in the United States. What did people do? They turned to the black market. They started making booze in their bathtubs. A bunch of gangsters popped up all over the place. And then all of a sudden, well, we got to have, you know, alcohol's back because people are doing all these things. We got to regulate this somehow. And I mean, the parallels are nearly identical.
It's the same. And even with marijuana, you wanted to legalize marijuana. A, you wanted the revenue from it, tax it and commercialize it. Tax it and regulate it. But the regulate part, let's not forget what that means. Regulate means produce safe, consumer-friendly, consistent product. That's what one of the main reasons that marijuana was legalized. So if you were to just send things to the prohibited list, they don't go away. They're just not consumer-friendly. And consumers are going to consume regardless. And that was one of the most interesting things is looking at Brightfield's consumer data study this year that showed that the younger generation prefers IHDs to marijuana products. In large parts, there's a lot of overlap, but they prefer it. It's not like it's displacing it. It's they would choose this over this, not because it's less taxed and less regulated, but because of the opposite, because it is in fact regulated in certain markets. So that data is interesting, but when it comes down to it, I think that you look at states like Kentucky, Tennessee, Florida, Arkansas, Colorado, just to name a few, they've all enacted very robust production standards and regulations over IHDs. They've created marketplaces. Now, Colorado's unique in that it's one of the largest manufacturing complexes for IHDs in the country, to the tune of about $700 million in infrastructure, about 3,600 jobs, almost $1 billion in annual revenue just from those, but it's all being sent to other states that have legal programs. And there are a number of legal states that have programs for what we refer to as red state weed. So it's not going anywhere. The states are seeing people have jobs. They're seeing infrastructure be built. They're seeing revenues come from taxation. And if it's a red state in particular, they don't have to acknowledge that they have legal marijuana in their state because it comes from hemp. And that sounds silly, but that is meaningful because hemp does not carry the stigma that marijuana does.
Yeah. No, and I think I actually was just reading today, there was some report from some federal agency or researcher that confirmed that. They were saying, hey, every state that doesn't have a regulated marijuana market has massively higher consumption and purchase rates, let's say, from consumers of IHD products. And so it's just confirming the fact that, yeah, at the end of the day, consumers are getting what they want. It seems to be, a similar model, if not providing access to the same products that we see in marijuana states. It's like, let them do it. And I think, going back to what we were just saying, it's a state issue. And they'll continue to do so.
It will happen regardless of what happens in Congress.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. The toothpaste is out of the tube. So let's pivot a little bit to some darker news topics, and that's kind of some of the pain the industry has felt this year. I'm sure most of our listeners have gotten wind or know about the California market. In California, the largest distributor, Herbal, did collapse this year because of unsustainable amounts of accounts receivable, accounts payables, and just a failure to reconcile, between those two terms that would allow the business to continue to operate. Essentially, retailers were owing, I don't know what the actual amounts were, but, millions of dollars to Herbal. Herbal was fronting that money to the production facilities, and Herbal was left in the lurch. And then when, time came to pay, there was nothing left to pay with. And so I think this is, we use Herbal as an example because it was the largest distributor in the largest market. But I think this is a problem that's endemic in every jurisdiction and state. Whether or not, the source of the problem is access to, kind of traditional institutional capital, going back to what you were saying about banks deploying, funds to cannabis operators if we do see Schedule 3, or if it's just kind of a little bit looser industry standards, the retailers are, sure, they're legitimate businesses, but maybe the business practices aren't up to par with some other industries. Like, I don't know. But I think, Herbal and California are not the only places where we've seen this squeeze. I mean, most operators we talk to, they're paying terms net 30, but then their vendors are paying them, net 80.
So they're basically extending loans.
Truly.
It's credit, right? They're extending credit, but they had no mechanism to evaluate.
Collect or to collect.
Well, to collect, most importantly, but they had no mechanism to evaluate the health of the companies that they're extending credit to. There is a company out there called C-Trust that I'm affiliated with, in full disclosure, that does that and does that for the industry. But my whole point being is there are ways, institutionalized ways, there are companies that are very good at every step of the way monitoring that debt. And that accounts receivable is, in fact, debt. It's a line of credit. And they're not checking the health of the companies they're working at. So all of a sudden, they're left holding this big bill and there's no cash behind it. And then it ultimately led to the collapse. Now, it's also somewhat unique because California has insisted upon this distributor system to create what looks like an hourglass. You've got your production at the top, and then the middle of the hourglass is the pinch point. That's the distributor who then distributes it out to the retail outlets. That was
almost like a liquor model.
A liquor model in many states, yes, certainly. But it was also it's a regulatory control model. So you know that if you need to shut things down, you just go to the distributors. It's easier to control and regulate, particularly in a market like California, which, you know, with what, 44 million people plus. So at the end of the day, it could have been avoided. It could have been monitored. But even if it was, if they were more on top of the health of the companies that are extending this credit to your point, there was no collection mechanism. And it's an example of building the plane while you fly it.
Truly.
Which is what happens in this industry all the time. And unfortunately, they forgot to put, I don't know, a tail fin on the plane.
A seat belt, yeah. Like and some passengers fell out.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a little morbid analogy.
They just didn't do it.
Right, they just didn't. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's a problem. And I do think that access to, you know, working capital is a great way for the industry to see some relief in this place or in this regard. And I do think that the work of companies like SeaTrust is going to be critical to the ongoing health of the industry. And, you know, with collections, it's interesting because typically cannabis companies that fail are placed into receivership. And I believe we've covered this concept in previous episodes. But now, you know, receivership is essentially bankruptcy without bankruptcy and not under the federal protections of Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It's more of a state-based process, as I understand it. But then this year, and I believe maybe it was in California, a judge did issue Chapter 11 protections to a company and said, hey, you can file for bankruptcy, even though you're, you know, performing a quasi-federally illegal business, you know, you can still apply for this relief, which I think was kind of remarkable.
I'm going to oversimplify this dramatically, but it's basically because that company was not presently engaged in the sale of the illegal substance. So the court afforded them that
because they were in bankruptcy. They said, well, you know, you're not selling any of this product. Let's just like divest all your assets.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yes. Or reorganize the debt and refinance.
Right. Interesting. Well, we'll maybe see, you know, additional kind of options like that for cannabis companies, you know, in the coming years. And especially if we do see some sort of Schedule 3 movement, I would expect that to open the gates a little bit further too.
You know, here's the interesting thing too, just thinking about the herbal scenario. If you did extend credit, how do you secure that credit? Meaning, if I say, all right, I'm gonna extend $1 million in financing to you, what's the collateral that I can come and take from you? Because of the strict regulations, I can't take your product necessarily. Now, there's ways that laws could allow that to happen if both companies were regulated under the same state law in the closed loop marijuana system, but you can't necessarily repossess and liquidate or sell the collateral to secure the loan, like cannabis, flowers, or oils, or products. So there is a flaw in the system, but it just needs to mirror other businesses, other industries, more and more and more. And I think the herbal scenario was just, again, one where they just moved too fast. And by the way, that company had an enormous, enormous valuation. I don't even want to take a guess at what it was, but it was, it went from this enormous valuation to literally worthless overnight.
Yeah. 6 months, I think. Yeah. Like almost literally overnight. So yeah, it's pretty remarkable watching that happen. But again, maybe indicative of a greater problem in the industry. Another big problem in the industry, that we've seen kind of a lot of news, you know, headlines about this year, I think is related to, you know, what I would call testing fraud. We've seen stories in multiple states of kind of this idea that testing labs are A, not following their own procedures and actually testing products the way they should be, or B, are beholden to the operators and are taking bribes, suggestions, who knows what it is, to actually put out results that are, you know, optimal for the person that produced the product. I wonder if we start to see you know, some consumer protection lawsuits. I think we did see some action in Oregon. There was a big issue out there with one lab in particular that was essentially, if I remember, if I got the facts right, they were certifying products as safe when they did have some, you know, above allowable limit concentration of, I believe it was asparagus. I think, I don't know, some natural harmful compound.
Like a mold.
A mold, right.
Aspergillus, I think is how you pronounce it. But yeah, those compounds, exactly.
Yeah. And so there's the issue of these testing labs not reporting when a product's contaminated with something it shouldn't be. And then there's the other issue of testing labs saying that a product has, you know, concentrations of cannabinoids far in excess of what it actually has. So that's where you start to see some results maybe where you're getting flower that's at, you know, 40% THC, which that's a little dicey. That's almost half the plant mass is going to be THC. I don't know about that.
Some of it is because the testing standards are not always implemented the same way by different labs. Some of it is
enforced.
Some of it is that they know what their clients want, and less than scrupulous actors will give the clients what they want because there are tight margins, very narrow margins in the testing industry in this space. It sometimes causes people to make bad choices, and that happens a lot. Sometimes the equipment's not calibrated properly.
Right.
The equipment requires great maintenance on a regular basis. And if you don't maintain the testing equipment, then the results are going to be all over the board. And sometimes it's a combination of all those things for convenience purposes to give the company the results at once, because then that has a direct and immediate effect in the marketplace.
Yeah.
If you can market that your product has X percent results and whatever that the consumer wants at that point in time, then that product's probably going to sell out very quickly.
It will.
And that's reminds me of the old days where on Colfax in Colorado, the old days where there were numbered dispensaries back to back to back, and like literally each sign in front of the dispensary says, our blueberry cough, strawberry cough, test that 42% THC. And the next one was, our BB King test that 38% THC. So it was a competition for that. And the reason they did that is because people would go in and buy that thing thinking that that was the end all be all, and that those testing results were either legit or that meant that the product was that much more superior, and it would sell out very quickly. So hopefully the testing labs ultimately get in line, but also hopefully they have an economic model that works for them so that these types of things don't happen on a regular basis. And I just don't see that right now.
No, you're right. They're struggling, I think, to survive. And I think most of them survive by, you know, maybe taking some illicit funds and doing things they shouldn't be doing. And I think the flip side of that's also the consumer, right? Consumers are no longer going out there and saying, I just want all the THC I could possibly get. They're starting to recognize, okay, there's some other cannabinoids in this plant. There's the entourage effect. There's terpenes. There's other things that maybe I want to go out and spend my money on. They're going to give me a more enjoyable experience than just, you know, 45% cannabis that's, you know, potentially going to give you a panic attack. So yeah, I think that's...
if you're lucky.
Right. Or yeah, you could just fly off into the clouds. And so, you know, I think the last thing I really want to touch on is kind of this concept of, well, it's a mix of regulatory participation and oversight in the industry, but also kind of corruption and some of the issues that we've started to see come out of some of these regulatory commissions and groups and regulators responsible for regulating the industry. I mean, I think Massachusetts, we just saw two of the managers of the program out there were suspended from their duties for, you know, I don't know, corrupt conduct, as I understand it. We saw that in, I think it was Michigan.
We saw that in Michigan for sure. Yeah.
And so I think we're starting to see, I mean, New York has had quite the turnover of kind of heads of the OCM, the Office of Cannabis Management out there. And I think we'll continue to see folks that recognize they have a lot of power and maybe abuse that power a little bit. And, you know, I guess put a black eye, if you will, on the cannabis industry, which is unfortunate.
Regulators have a very, very challenging job, especially in this space. But the problem is what you just said. maybe it's a power trip, but it's also that they think they understand the industry. And all they're seeing is a slice of the industry. And they think they understand it, and they think they understand what their job is and what's best. And they don't necessarily have any perspective. And so their confidence in what they know is entirely unfounded. And that leads them to ultimately put themselves into a corner sometimes without knowing that they've done so. And that's where I see some things that shake out, unfortunately, where corruption's unveiled and that kind of thing. But it's also endemic in some states. Some states, corruption is just the norm. I mean, look, Colorado, I'm not saying there's no corruption in Colorado, but Colorado is about as clean and squeaky clean as you can be politically from agency perspective. Those things, while they likely happen, it doesn't happen on any wide scale. And there's no history or culture of that like there would be in New Jersey or Nevada or New York.
Albany.
And again, I don't know specific instances in those other states. I'm just saying, generally speaking, the culture of corruption in government doesn't exist in Colorado. So we're a bit spoiled here. But at the end of the day, whether it's a corruption culture or whether it's just the regulator drinking their own Kool-Aid and thinking that they've mastered this issue and they know it so well, they're going to back themselves into a corner because they can't possibly be right about what they know because it's all brand new and their perspective is just that. It's the one slice of the pizza. And by the way, I've always said, you know what a pizza saver is?
I don't.
Pizza saver is the white circle that
yes,
you put in
the table
of the pizza. So it keeps the top of the pizza box from pulling the cheese off.
Oh, I thought that was just a little table for the pizza men to have a little meal in.
They sit there as well. But it prevents the box from the cheese from attaching to the box. I like to say that we and people that work broadly like we do, we sit on top. We are the pizza men. We sit on top of that little pizza saver so we get to see the whole pizza. Everybody else is a piece of pepperoni on one of the slices or stuck in a crack or the delicious runny oil between the crust and where the cheese and the sauce starts. My point being is that that's what a regulator is. A regulator is just a piece on one slice and it's only one part, but yet they think they understand the whole pizza and they don't. And that's what I think leads people to make poor decisions, back themselves into corners, and ultimately double down on the decisions that they've made, which causes them to make deals and or leverage the fact that they can't make mistakes, and they go on that power trip. And that happens all too often.
And I think there's an unfortunate kind of echo chamber happening with regulators right now. I mean, I don't know, specific organizations or not. I think it's really just, who else do you look to when you have a state that's legalizing, you know, medical or recreational cannabis? Say, okay, what am I supposed to do now? Oh, well, I'm going to look at some of my predecessors or my neighbors that are doing the same thing and ask them how they do it. And then unfortunately, you know, you're picking up some of the good, but you're also picking up some of the bad. So hopefully we see, you know, maybe a little bit of innovation when it comes to regulating the industry. And one specific example I think that, you know, we might just mention here at the end is the Cresco deal. It was, you know, Cresco and PharmaCann. That we're going to merge this year.
Columbia Care.
Sorry, PharmaCann and Cresco already have merged.
PharmaCann is a slightly different scenario.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Big companies, MSOs. But anyways, the Cresco deal, the combination with Columbia Care, it ultimately, you know, both sides were ready to rock. Everything seemed green, go, and then all of a sudden, regulators and compliance with regulations got in the way of that deal. Turns out, some of the states they wanted to. You know, merge their operations in, there were regulations that said that they had to divest some of their assets. You couldn't have both companies holding licenses in that state. They had to consolidate things. And they just weren't able to get that done in time to finalize the deal. And so it fell apart. And so just kind of a specific example of the role that a regulator might play to not just protect consumers, not just protect, you know, the public, but also kind of get in the way of good business in the cannabis space. And I mean, I say good business because this combination wasn't, you know, illegal, right? I'm sure there's people out there that think it was a bad idea, or there's people out there that think it was a good idea. But at the end of the day, it just didn't happen because know, these guys failed to understand the regulations and failed to comply with
it. Yeah, there's a few lessons in there. You know, those are two of the largest cannabis companies in the U.S., Columbia Care and Cresco. They would have merged to create far and away the widest footprint in the country. And they worked with very, very prominent lawyers, law firms. We know the lawyers that were involved in some of those deals, who are extremely brilliant and talented at in terms of putting deals together and the transactional element. But they, I don't want to say they ignore the regulatory piece, because they don't ignore things. Lawyers like that don't ignore pieces. They just don't fully grasp them. They understand them at the grassroots. And, you know, as a national practice like we have, it's difficult for us to have the kind of regulatory expertise across the country that an attorney in a particular state will have at a great level of depth in that state. So that's what's missing in a deal like that. And there's ultimately more to the story there. And I'm not saying as if I know, I'm just saying there's got to be, because at the end of the day, they decided, well, we have no penalties to terminate this agreement and walk away, so let's just walk away. Most times, people would try to salvage the deal and go forward. I think what they saw in each other was that the performance was declining because of the economy was declining surrounding cannabis and the economy as a whole. I think what they saw in each other is that the numbers that were provided were not misrepresented or fraud, but maybe the numbers were not, you know, exactly what was happening in
or
those
countries. Trending down, right?
Yes,
right.
Yes. So, and so those things taken together caused those companies to decide to
break
terminate
up
that deal.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's probably for the best, because to have a company that size in the space would have stretched all of their resources thin for the same reason we talked about Herbal. Cresco and Columbia Care are not perfect companies. Those companies, too, are airplanes that are being built while they're being flown. So you just don't know what pieces are missing yet until it crashes. And I think that that's another thing that that was avoided by the culmination of that murder.
Right. Maybe it was an issue that they dodged, a bullet they dodged there, if you will. Well, listen, I mean, we've done quite the whirlwind tour of 2023. You know, I know we maybe mentioned we would look into the future of 2024 a little bit at the top of the episode, but I'm thinking maybe we save that for, you know, first episode of the new year, kick off 2024 with a bang, a little bit of a crystal ball, and that we wrap this episode here.
Deal.
Right on. Well, happy holidays, folks. Hope everyone is able to spend some time with loved ones. Happy New Year, and looking forward to coming back at you in January.
Thanks for joining us for another enlightening conversation. If you liked what you heard, hit that subscribe button to get all future episodes fresh out of the studio. Suggestions for topics or guests for the show, please send them to hello@bobhoban.com. And as always, thanks to Benzinga for powering the Hoban Minute.